Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Researchers at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, or HUI, have traveled to some of the most remote and inhospitable parts of the world. Not only are they learning more about our planet, their work is helping to shape exploration to other inhospitable places like space. One of those researchers joins us today. Chris German is a senior scientist at HUI. He's explored hydrothermal vents and tracked life in extreme environments on the seafloor of almost every ocean basin on Earth for the past 30 years. Chris, welcome back. It's been a while since we've seen you. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Mindy. It's good to be here.
So first, tell us, what is a hydrothermal vent, and can you describe the physical process that creates them?
Yeah. So if you break it down, the two parts, hydro and thermal, basically anything that involves water, that's the hydro part, and heat, the thermal, counts as hydrothermal. So there's lots of different ways you can get that, but it's basically anywhere where you have warm rock, so geothermal energy, and water can penetrate down into that and can circulate down into the rock, get heated up, and then come back out and bring the heat back out.
When we say heat, this is, temperatures are pretty hot.
They can be very hot at the high end. And they don't only happen in the oceans, of course. So Yellowstone, for example, is a great example of a hydrothermal system on a continent. But the hottest temperatures we've seen get up to about 400 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
But most of the hydrothermal flow may actually be a lot cooler. And so it depends what kind of flavor scientist you are, which kind is most interesting to you. Mm-hmm. If you're a physicist, then the coolest stuff, the coldest stuff, is the stuff that actually transports most heat because there's a lot of it. If you're a chemist, then you get really excited about the hottest stuff because that's the thing that actually dissolves things up. And then if you're a biologist, you probably want somewhere in that Goldilocks zone because the really hot acid that comes out of something like a black smoker, we call them, the hottest chimneys, is basically like knocking off a fire hydrant and having hot acid spewing out of it. So it's not a great place to live. But the energy that's nearby can be great, so in the periphery of that. But then the question then becomes, well, where are all the other places that life could be getting energy from these things?
And so where do you fall in this spectrum?
I do it all.
All of it,
I have some kind of attention deficit disorder thing. So, I mean, I really enjoy the exploration of tracking these systems down. And it's a really humbling thing. So for 30 years, I continue to surprise myself by finding things that I didn't know was there on the planet.
The thought is, when we discovered these hydrothermal vents, that there would be no life. So what kinds of organisms thrive in this environment?
Well, the first ones we found were on the East Pacific Rise, or this is just before my time, before I got involved. So there's a big volcanic chain that runs down the east side of the Pacific Ocean, and the hydrothermal vents there, the two like most obvious charismatic fauna that they hosted were giant tube worms and giant clams. The clams were like about a foot long. I mean, they were like the size of a dinner plate, individual clams.
And that was a surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the first discoveries followed really fast on the back of the plate tectonic revolution. So people understood, oh, there are these topographic highs which got discovered really during World War II when people were actually mapping the seafloor, or basically for military purposes, trying to work out where you might hide a submarine. Then they found out that there was this consistent chain of volcanoes. And so everyone was then interested of, well, if there's heat from volcanoes at the bottom of the ocean that are driving plate tectonics, then where does the heat go? And maybe it doesn't all come out through conduction. The easiest way to explain the difference between conduction and convection is boiling a pan of water. Mm-hmm. If you heat the base of your pan, the heat gets from the cooking surface through the bottom of the pan through conduction, but then the water as it boils transports the water through convection, and so that's a much more effective way of getting heat out of a system. And the Earth does the same thing. So water that penetrates through rock and comes back out again can strip the heat out. And so there was this prediction of, if you went to one of these volcanic chains, there should be some kind of convection process that would be taking heat out. What nobody expected was that there would be chemical energy would be released at the same time, that the chemistry that came out, or because the fluids coming out were different in chemistry from the ocean, then when those two kinds of fluids reacted together, there would be energy there that life could exploit.
Yeah. So this was the 1970s when we were seeing discovering the first hydrothermal vents. What was the scientific community response to that?
it was kind of interesting. It was kind of a slow uptake. I think it was a bit of a specialist thing. It was very much a niche thing of like, oh, they found it in a place in the Pacific. I was still in college when I first found out about it, when the first papers came out. I think the first paper about a black smoker came out probably when I was in my senior year. And at the time, you know, I remember writing essays of explaining why you wouldn't find hydrothermal activity in the Atlantic. Because people had been working in the Atlantic and they hadn't seen it, and then they found it in the Pacific. And so it was like, you know, an immediate need to cover your tracks. It's mm-hmm. like, well, it isn't because I didn't see it. It's because it wasn't there. So, I mean, I wrote the essays because that's what I had to do to get the grades and get the funding for my PhD, but I didn't really believe it. And
yeah.
so...
Yeah, interesting. We've been taught that all energy on Earth comes from the sun. So do hydrothermal events upend that notion?
Mm-hmm. Frankly, yeah. So that's it. We do get a lot of our energy from the sun, and most of our biology on this planet is driven by photosynthesis, and that's the primary source of energy. But there has been heat locked into the Earth since it formed, this volcanic energy, and so there's this geothermal energy, and people tap into that, places like Iceland, right? I mean, all of their electricity, nearly all of their utilities are fueled through geothermal energy that's driving that system. And that's just one little spot where, the tens of thousands of miles of mid-ocean ridge, that's one of the places where it pops up above sea level. But that's a chain that runs all around the whole planet. So there's this finite amount, which probably was a lot hotter, like at the start of Earth's history, and it's been slowing down, but it's a pretty well-throttled heat release. So it's basically a thing that's been sustained over tens, hundreds of millions of years that it's been going on at the bottom of our ocean.
So you mentioned you were in college when mm-hmm. you heard about this. So what got you interested in hydrothermal vents?
They were just really cool. I mean, it was like my PhD was studying ocean chemistry anyway. So I went on to study ocean chemistry, and I was studying places like stagnant basins like the Black Sea, and some fields off Canada, so places where the seafloor shape is so narrow and tightly constrained that the water at the bottom of it kind of goes stagnant and it runs out of oxygen. And so I got really interested in the process of what happens when you get these two water masses, one with oxygen and one without. And then I realized, oh, the stuff that's happening at that interface, at that layer, must be exactly the same thing that's actually happening in hydrothermal vents because they were so new. So that was what first brought me here. I was at MIT and a guest investigator at Woods Hole back in the late 1980s was basically testing that hypothesis.
That was going to say, you're not originally from the US, you're from the UK.
Yeah.
It was MIT what brought you to the States then? And then how did you end up here in Woods Hole?
Well, the guy who was the pioneer in studying hydrothermal vents was a guy called John Edmond, who was a professor at MIT. He always joked, and then the submersible he was using was Alwyn, which is the vehicle that's here. He used to joke that if you listen to how many people said that they were in Alwyn the day that the vents were first discovered, it used to be a 22-seater submersible. But there were probably about that many people who were on the ship. So yeah, there were people who were like,
that's funny.
In the moment, but there was only one pilot and two scientists actually on
that's
the seafloor.
That's all
on the
will fit. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about how you identify places in the ocean where there is the potential for hydrothermal vents. What are you looking at when you go, let's go explore, here?
So traditionally, we start off with a map of the shape of the seafloor, which you can even get from satellite altimeters nowadays, that if there's a big volcanic bulge on the seafloor, the gravitational pull of that is enough to change sea level slightly, just fractionally. But satellites now can actually map those things out, so you can see the line of where the volcanic chains are. And then in terms of telling whether or not there's anything interesting in the vicinity at any one location, the way we work is to look for chemical anomalies in the water column. So there's certainly for the high temperature vents. So this is... I'm going to give you the answer that was true till about 2 years ago.
Okay.
Because for 30 years of my career, it was working just fine until I realized maybe it wasn't. So for black smoke events, they have a lot of heat in them. So they kick up into the water column a bit like the smokestack from a factory. They kick things up into the ocean, which can disperse a long way. So some of the chemicals that are in the vents themselves are about a million times higher than seawater concentrations. So that means if you imagine like putting food dye into a stream or something like that, you can trace it a long way away. So the vent site might be no bigger than our studio, you know, the size of a room in a house. But you can actually like smell it. You know, you'd probably be able to smell it up at the Bourne Bridge, for example, if there was a vent here in the chimney. So it's tens of miles away at least. So that was the kind of thing we figured. Is that, well, if you just wander along a volcanic chain and then just take a sample every 10 miles or so, you either will or won't see a signal. And if you don't see anything, then you just keep going. And if you do see something, then it's time to stop and actually try a bit harder and see what you would do. And that was basically, we would either just do that and just put in these little fence posts, mm-hmm. or once I moved back to the UK, I started working with geophysicists who would actually tow things through the ocean near the seafloor. So I started putting different kinds of sensors on their instruments. So while they were taking images of the seafloor, I could actually do the chemical sniffing in real time and get that information for free. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a boss for 10 years and he used to say, you know, you get really nervous. Every time you go on a ship, you wonder whether there's going to be any hydrothermal activity there or not. And you always find some. Mm. So why does it, like, every time we start a new cruise, are you kind of agitated about whether it's going to be there or not? And it's like, well, because it might not be. Yeah. And that's the point of exploration. It's okay for you because we know the seafloor is going to be there, right? If the seafloor isn't there, then we've got something much bigger to worry about than whether our cruise is a research success or not.
Yeah. But, so you said that was true up until a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I'd been thinking about this idea that we know, in terms of chemical signals, we know that the black smoker systems that are really hot kick out a lot of chemical discharge that's different from the rest of the ocean. And we know that right at that hot fluid isn't very hospitable, but there's a whole area around it which is warm and produces enough chemical energy that they become thriving ecosystems. And then the question became, well, what if there's other places where there's just the warm water without the hot water, and they might be thriving ecosystems, and the animals might be having a great time there, but because we have this very myopic way of, well, we know what used to work, so that's what we've got into, maybe we'd fallen into a rut. We only had one way of exploring, which was looking for chemical staining in the water column, but that's only going to find a particular kind of hydrothermal circulation. So then when you remember hydrothermal just means heat and water,
right?
There's lots of other ways you can do that. And so, in fact, you were asking earlier, what brought me to Woods Hole? It was really the pioneering use of autonomous underwater vehicles. So Hui has this wonderful legacy that's anchored in Alvin, but then it learned, you know, from that, people learned, well, how would you have a robot that does a lot of the same kinds of things that Alvin can do? And that's what the Jason ROV is. It's mm-hmm. also part of the national facility here at Woods Hole. But then the third component that actually wasn't part of the facility till I got here was the pioneering autonomous underwater vehicle, Abe, which could swim around. And we'd learned early on that once you can only get so far in terms of tracking a vent down by looking for those chemical staining the old-fashioned way. And then Abe turned out to be the first of the AUVs we used to say, OK, if you get this close, now you can actually start flying around in square waves and mowing the lawn and getting close to the seafloor, up to the point where you can even photograph the vents. Even without bringing Alvin or Jason yet, you can find the vent and photograph it and even know what kind of animals are there. So that had kept me pretty happy and busy from 2004, was the first time we did that, through to about the early 2020s. And then came this question of, well, what if there's other stuff that's in between that we're missing? And I realized that that was something that Abe had been very good at, that flying close to the seafloor, it could actually, even within an area, say like a size of a football field, it could find the warm patches. It could actually identify where there were little patches that were warm that weren't the main black smoker, but that's where the animals were happiest. And so with its successor, Sentry, which has a much longer endurance, it became feasible to actually just drive down to the seafloor and then just drive along a section of ridge where people had found all the black smokers previously. They'd been known for about 20 years, but nobody had been back for 20 years, and it's one of the most volcanically active places on Earth. So it was kind of fun to go back and see how the seafloor had changed. But then we were able to fly Sentry along this thing, and in a place where there were five black smokers that were known previously, we found evidence for 50 different places where there were patches with warm water and enough difference for it to show up as a chemically enriched water. Mm-hmm. So a place where there was energy for life, but only five of those were the black smokers. The other 45 were things that we would have missed the way I used to search.
And were the five black smokers still there and the same as when they were discovered 20 years ago?
I think three or four of them were in the same place, mm-hmm. and then one of them had like stopped and a new one had started. Yeah, I mean, it was the what became apparent. We had a colleague of mine from South Carolina, Scott White, who had been a graduate student 20 years ago on the original thing. And then we were back basically collecting the second ever of the same data set of actually having these like aerial photographs, like using sonar, but taking aerial photographs of the seafloor. And he said it had always become apparent, not at the time when they were doing the work 20 years ago, but about 5 years later, it was like, oh, we must have been there right after an eruption.
Now
it was clear that he said, okay, so that place has continued to cool down. And then this next section about 50 miles further south, that's the place that's had a more recent eruption. That's the part where the seafloor doesn't look the same as it did 20 years ago. That's been paved right over.
So as you're looking beyond just, as you're saying, the smokers, the really hot, everything. So are you finding these hydrothermal vents then everywhere? I mean, are they in oceans across the globe?
I think they're probably, well, we really don't know.
Know.
There's so much of it, but that's exactly the question. It's opening our eyes to, or it's making us be a little bit more humble of thinking, well, we knew we could just go and look along the volcanic seams of mid-ocean ridges and we would find things there. And now the question is, well,
where else might that, they
be? Yeah. What are all the different kinds of hydrothermal activity that could occur? And then it's, okay, geologically, where would it make sense? Where else might you look? I've been spending a lot of time recently getting more paying attention to stuff that I'd neglected, which were hotspot volcanoes in the middle of oceans. There are several. There's one just south of Hawaii, and there's one east of Tahiti. So all of these places that have like exotic tropical islands have like there's a leading edge. Each of them, like Hawaii, is a chain of islands, and Hawaii itself, the big island, is the most active volcanically. That's where Kilauea has been erupting just recently. But just south of that, leading edge, the next island that's going to exist, like the next investment opportunity for real estate, if you're going to be around for a few million years, is a place called Kamaehua Kanaloa, which is an underwater volcano, which is within about 1,000 meters now. So it comes up from 5,000 meters to 1,000 meters, but it hasn't reached all the way to the surface yet, but it's still growing.
But it will, yeah, wow. We are talking about ocean exploration, in particular hydrothermal vents this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Chris German, senior scientist at WHOE, who's explored hydrothermal vents and tracked life in extreme environments for the last 30 years. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a comment or a question for us, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So you're talking about these vents that vary from like really hot, like the smokers, to just, you know, warm here. So I imagine you're finding different types of life depending on the different type of hydrothermal vents, right? So what are, you mentioned the clams and the worms. So what are we seeing? Like, you'd think these smokers, you'd think what could possibly live around them because of all, even just the chemicals, not just the heat, but there is life around these really hot ones as well. So what are the different types of life that you're finding in the different types of vents?
Well, that's really interesting. That was basically the driving force for all the exploration we did between about 2000 and 2010 was exactly that, was the first vents were found in the Pacific. So they had these different kinds of tube worms and the clams we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then the first vent sites that did get found in the Atlantic, in that same place in the community structure, was taken by blind shrimp, millions of them. So it was something completely different. And so the question became, well, where does that change? Why aren't the animals the same? The geology was not exactly the same, but the chemistry was remarkably similar. You know, the geologic processes were, if you've got a certain kind of lava that erupts that makes up most of the seafloor called basalt, and you've got seawater, which to a first approximation is mostly sodium chloride salt at about 3.5%, then the chemistry is pretty much the same, but you get these completely different animals. But we only had two places. We knew what the animals were like in the North Atlantic, where deep water forms, and then it flows south through the Atlantic and into the Indian Ocean, and then through into the Pacific. And then we knew what was happening in the Northeast Pacific at the far end of the conveyor belt. And it's like, okay, where do things change? And so that's where we started going to different places. So One of the first places I went to was actually Antarctica, to the Southern Ocean, to go and see where the point of connection was. Actually, we did two. We did one, went to the South Atlantic, Southern Mid-Atlantic Ridge, just south of the equator, because there's a big offset between the volcanic chain in the North Atlantic and the South Atlantic, which kind of mimics where the bulge is in Africa and where Brazil sticks out in South America. So we said, okay, well, there's a big fracture zone there. There might not be any hydrothermal activity there. So maybe all the Pacific animals get all the way up to the South Atlantic. So we went to the South Atlantic, found the first vent sites there, and they looked just the same as the North Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And then a colleague of mine, Tim Shank, was part of a program with Cindy Vandover was the lead, but a lot of Hui scientists went to a first place where hydrothermal activity was found in the Indian Ocean. And the shrimp were the kind of like, it was the same kind of shrimp, or it looked remarkably similar shrimp there. So then it's like, oh, so then is everything like the Atlantic and it gets somewhere? And then people said, ah, well, you found vents in the Atlantic and you found vents in the Pacific, but there's a connecting rod in the southern Indian Ocean, which is one of the slowest spreading bits of mid-ocean ridge at all. It's hardly volcanically active at all. There are whole sections where there is no volcanism. I bet that's like a barrier to gene flow. I bet no organisms can make it from one side to the other. So that'll be extinct. There'll be no hydrothermal vents. And so that'll be where there's a barrier and why you get two different kinds of animals. And we went there and had no trouble finding evidence for hydrothermal activity. But the animals there are different again. It's a third population, which weirdly are the same as the ones that people had found at about the same time in the Lau Basin, an area in the Southwest Pacific. And so it turns out that we weren't even asking the right question. We were such a North Hemisphere environment of saying, why are the vent animals in the North Pacific different from the animals in the North Atlantic? And in fact, if you were sitting above the South Pole and looking at things, you realize that there's a whole chain of volcanic ridges that go round and round Antarctica, and there's an ocean circulation that goes round and round Antarctica, and there's all kinds of things called stalked barnacles. And the one of the most exotic animals around, called a yeti crab. So it's a crab that all of these animals don't get their food directly from the chemistry, all these the charismatic animals we care about or get excited about that look good on TV. They're all fueled by microbes, and it's the microbes that are taking advantage. They're the things that are actually harvesting the chemical energy and turning it into how to convert carbon dioxide into carbon for life. And that's what's the base of the food chain. So those aren't necessarily different everywhere. I mean, there's a whole study of that. That's a new field of what's the biodiversity of the microbiology. But that was influencing that and dispersion. How do animals get from one place to another? So these yeti crabs, it turns out the way they actually get their food is that they actually have like lots of little filaments on their arms. And that's where the bacteria, they provide basically a garden. So they have a cottage garden for the microbes, which then they can strip off, and that's where they get the food and they draw it into their mouth. But they just have these giant front claws, like then they just look really hairy. So that's how they got their name of the yeti crab.
Yeah. So with the life that you're finding in the hydrothermal vents, is this life that you see elsewhere that existed, or is this new life that you're finding?
A bit of both. With the large fauna, they are new species. I think we worked out that from the first discovery of vents up to the year 2000, new species had been found at a rate of about one every 2 weeks.
Wow.
For that 25 years.
Yeah.
And in biology, you kind of, one of the ways you know whether or not you've found everything is that at some point, the more you keep looking, the number of new species that you find, the rate of discovery drops off. For 10 years, the Census of Marine Life really, really made a big push of like, let's go to new places, find new vents, find what's going on. The rate never dropped off.
Wow.
The funding dropped off. The investment of like, it became unfashionable of like, okay, we've done that for 10 years, let's go do something else. It's not like we actually found out everything that's living in the ocean, and all the evidence was, you know, we probably went from having explored 10% of the world's volcanic ridges to having explored 20%. So it's still 80% unexplored.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't understand that, right? Like how we really know maybe more about space than we even do about our own planet, right? When you're looking at the oceans.
And that's exactly how I got into, that was my original motivator to actually get involved with space research, was the flip side of that was, yeah, if we had the kind of budgets available for ocean technology, that
space has,
then, you know, it was then, you know, imagine if we had better ways of exploring, if we could actually get some of the best minds into how do we develop better technologies to accelerate the rate of exploration, because it is really hard.
Yeah.
And if you're just doing it on a ship that can only travel at 10 miles an hour to get somewhere, and then you have to slow down to like 1 or 2 miles an hour once you get to the area you want to explore to make sure you don't miss stuff with all the technology, that's a lot of ships.
Yeah.
Right? It would take, you know, if you want to get to a point where you understand everything, sticking with the current technology isn't the way to go. And that's always been one of the real highlights of Hui. In fact, that's why one of the reasons I came here was it's a place where the engineers and the scientists sit alongside one another, and there's this wonderful positive feedback of scientists who are like, say, well, I'd really like to know this, but I can't because there isn't the technology to develop it. And then there's technologists going like, well, I can't do that, but I found that I can do this instead. How would you use that? And then scientists can think about, oh, if I had that capability.
Yeah.
And so it's that.
And you sort of mentioned, and I want to get to how we're exploring here. You spent time in Alvin, right, looking at the vents. But at one point you considered yourself claustrophobic, and I can understand that. So tell us about your first experience in a submersible and how you got over the claustrophobia.
Okay. I don't think I did.
Yeah, you still feel it.
I'm still claustrophobic. I remember the first time I went out on any research ship at all, it was actually working on the first vents that had just been discovered in the Atlantic. And I was on a British ship, and the Woods Hole ship Atlantis with Alvin was like at the same location. You know, we could just see them over the horizon. They were just leaving a site as we arrived. And somebody said, you know, would you ever go in Alvin? And I said, I hope I never get the chance. And he was like, why? I said, well, because I'm going to go. If I get the chance, there's no way I'm going to say no. I really do suffer with claustrophobia. I'm going to have to get over myself. And it was a lovely thing. So the first time I actually got in Alvin was the fact that you had to have a briefing. So the senior pilot at the time, as we were driving out to our study site, had to jump in the sub with somebody else. And this guy just gave us a 1 hour lecture about what every single dial. And it's like being inside an aircraft cockpit. Mm. And I was just sitting there going like, I should have brought a notepad. Do I need to know all this stuff? Because he was going through it really fast. Mm-hmm. And then he just turned around at the end and said, are there any questions? And I said, yeah, how much of this do I need to know? And he said, the first thing I told you about, you just pick up that voice-activated phone and talk to somebody on the surface. Like, if there's anything wrong and the pilot's not in action, that's all you need to do. They'll tell you everything. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, so what was all the rest of it? I said, that was just me sitting here watching you guys and seeing whether you're going to freak out or not over 20 minutes while you're in the submersible.
Interesting. Wow.
And so that was the thing that... So I'd already got over all that stuff. I'd learned, okay, I can sit here and be completely distracted inside the submersible. Yeah. And in real life, on the seafloor,
yeah.
It was just, there's so much to see out the window. You don't actually, you have to stop and actually remember that's what you're doing. Because otherwise you're just on like this most amazing car journey.
So do the submersible pilots, I mean, you know, especially if you're on a smoker, can you get, do they get trained in how to safely navigate around these vents, especially the ones that are really hot, right?
Yeah. Yes, of course they, you know, it's an environment you treat with respect.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a whole thing of understanding the perception of actually where you're going to go. If a scientist wants to actually do something, if there's a particular kind of sample they want to collect or they want to film something in a certain way, the pilots actually are the people who spend most of the time on the seafloor. So they have a lot of embedded knowledge that scientists take advantage of. Well, how would we actually position the vehicle to actually get the samples we want? How would we approach this? And so there's a wonderful partnership, you know, that science technology partnership cascades down to interpersonal relationships at the seafloor of how we go about these things.
Yeah. Talk to Eric, who's giving us a call from Sandwich. Hi, Eric.
Good morning. Wonderful show. I'm curious whether you're finding that the species diversity in the area of influence of these vents is kind of homogeneous, or do you find some species kind of living on that boundary where conditions are intolerable for life? So are there some more robust species that have kind of developed a niche in the area where conditions are poorer than they are closer to the actual vents?
Great question. Actually has two answers. So from the perspective of the macrofauna, the things that you can see in the photographs, something I learned early on was I had sort of some biologist friends back when I moved back to the UK who were really not interested in vents. And I wondered why. And he said, well, the biodiversity is actually really poor. There's actually not that many different species. There are some species that are unique and have adapted to life around the vents. But the only thing that's really interesting about them is biomass. It's like how profuse they are. So it's not like at a South African rain or a South American rainforest. There's the same profusion of life, but there's not a whole bunch of different species like there are in a rainforest. If you actually want the highest biodiversity in the Pacific Ocean, for example, you go to the deep abyssal plains where life is most barren. But it's so hard to eke out a living, life has found many, many different ways. But the second part of your question about the extremes, in the microbial life, there are some amazing things. In fact, the known limits to life now go up to 126 degrees Celsius. So way beyond, you know, the boiling point of water at the Earth's surface. That's something that's particularly interesting is the things that are at the base of the food chain seem to be able to do many weird and wonderful things that we hadn't anticipated.
Eric, thanks for that question. Great question. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Chris German, senior scientist at HUI. He's explored hydrothermal vents and tracked life in extreme environments for over 30 years, learning more about our planet, but also this work is helping to shape space exploration. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before we get to the space stuff, I got a couple other questions for you, Chris. You mentioned, we talked about Alvin, but also, you're using ROV. So talk about the difference between what you're able to do in your studies, ROV versus submersibles.
Okay. Let's think. The submersible has like this infinite mobility on the seafloor because you're not tethered to anything. An ROV is connected via a cable. So it does two things that are like transformative. One is, because you have this infinite power coming down from the ship, the batteries never run out like they do in Alvin. But the flip side of that is when you want to move across and explore somewhere, then you have to drag a cable with you. So the deeper you go, the more of a challenge it gets. But one of the other things I like about the Jason ROV in particular is, well, that's the one I've worked with most. In fact, so much that I liked it so much that I bought one. but that's another story. That was back in the UK. But you can actually, I call it like the democratization of science, that with Alvin, you can film things and you can come back. But on Alvin cruises, one of the things I always knew was you'd all be sitting around all day waiting for the people to come back. Well, it's not like you weren't busy working with samples, but two people got the real adventure of the day. And then they, like after dinner, would give you the debrief of what they saw. The first time we went out with an ROV, I realized that not only did the people in the control van, they had like a little mission control in a couple of 20-foot containers on the back of the ship. So there were people who were on watch who knew what was happening. But then you could have basically rolling clock that people could rotate through watches like they do on a ship generally, so that you could rotate people through. So lots of different people got to see what was going on. And in the meantime, you could actually pipe that video from one cabin, one place to another. And for example, even in the mess, because I remember the first experience I had of why that was transformative was I was sitting in the control van of Jason on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge in 1996, listening to two of my colleagues who are future colleagues in the G&G department here at Woods Hole, debating of what kind of animal it was they were specifically looking at. And I knew we had the world authority on vent biology, Cindy Vandover, on the ship as well. I said, well, why don't we ask Cindy? And I was just like the newbie sitting in the back row. I was just meant to be like typing in what the clever people were saying. And they said, well, she's not here. I said, well, no, but, you know, she's not far away. And she's coming on watch in like 20 minutes. And they said, yeah, but she'll be eating breakfast. And I figured, right, so we don't even have to disrupt her. I just like picked up the phone, called the mess. And it was always the captain always sat next to the thing. So it was always him, A.D. Colburn, that would pick up the phone and answer it. And I just said, oh, it's Cindy Vandover there. And he said, yeah, I'll just get her. And I said, no, no, don't need to. Just can you ask her to look up at the TV screen in the corner of the mess and tell us what animal it is we're looking at? And he just shouted across the mess to Cindy, and she told him, and he told me, and I put the phone down, and I just typed it in.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, then that's been where that's taken to its next extreme, is the stuff that Bob Ballard pioneered in with the Ocean Exploration Trust. And the EV Nautilus is then saying, okay, well, then if you get to the point where you can get stuff from the seafloor to the ship, then you can get stuff from the ship out via satellite communications nowadays to the shore, and everybody can join in.
Mm. So what was the animal?
It was a Galathea crab.
Okay. All right. So you're heading to the Arctic Ocean to explore the vent beneath an ice-covered ocean.
Yeah.
Certainly, this is a challenging environment to conduct research. So talk about some of the challenges and why these vents are worth the trouble of all of these challenges.
Okay. Let's do the why bother.
Yeah.
Let's start with. So it started off until I went to that place I was telling you about in the Indian Ocean, which was so volcanically inactive. The other place that's as volcanically inactive is in the Arctic. So there's a line of volcanic ridge that runs all the way across from just north of Greenland and runs aground in Siberia. That's the deepest, slowest, most miserable volcanically inactive vent or ridge there should be. But based on the chemical prospecting we'd done elsewhere, around 2001, a former postdoc of mine, I kind of like loaded her up with all the right equipment, and she went off on an expedition for 2 months with two icebreakers and did that fence post sampling and found evidence and said, there's actually plenty of venting here.
Wow.
There's lots of venting to be had in the Arctic. And it was like, okay, well, it's there, good. But that's like, we'll leave it alone. It turned out there was one tiny sliver that isn't in the roaring 40s in the Southern Ocean and not in the Arctic, which actually has exactly the same credentials, which is the Mid-Cayman Rise, just south of the Cayman Islands in the tropics. So, in fact, the first time I got any space exploration money was because what we'd found out was that in these places that are not volcanically very active, the kinds of rocks you interact with can actually be different. They're not the basalts that make up most of the seafloor. They're more like the rocks that form much deeper on the Earth today, but are the kind that would have erupted right when the Earth was very young. And so we'd found some of those types of vents in the Atlantic, and they looked just like black smokers, so we hadn't thought that much about it. And then I read a theoretical paper with a colleague that I work with quite a lot now, who'd actually said, well, during early Earth, if you'd had rocks of that kind erupting at the seafloor as lavas, and then you had seawater with carbon dioxide in it pumping through those things, in those hydrothermal systems, you would expect that carbon dioxide to spontaneously, in the absence of life, start making organic compounds, including things that would be the precursor to life.
Wow.
But in his paper, he said, but those things haven't erupted on the seafloor of the Earth for the last 2,000 million years, so we won't know. Oh. And then I realized that by going to the world's slowest spreading ridges, I'd actually found vent sites where that combination of rocks and water were happening.
So when you're looking at this, like you say, precursor to life, your research there and the finding that this in the Arctic can inform future space exploration.
Yeah. And so the stepping stone really was we went to this area in the Caribbean, and that's when I kind of like drew in a couple of my colleagues here at Woods Hole, Jeff Seward, who studies organic geochemistry of hydrothermal systems, and Julie Huber, who works at the cutting edge of like the microbes that go with that. And so the vents we went to, the first place NASA funded us was to say, okay, well, we're going to need a special kind of robot now that uses the real-time telemetry that Jason has, but it also needs to have the freedom of movement that Alvin has. And then the way we do that is using a single optical fiber, which is very fragile. So if it breaks, then the vehicle also has to be as smart as our Sentry AUV and come out. So it has to have everything that each of three different purpose-built vehicles can do. And so the first place we went to do that was saying, like, so let's not just go straight under the ice and risk it. Let's actually go somewhere that's got all the right conditions and test it. And so NASA funded us to do that by going to the Caribbean. And so we found these vents. And so we deliberately, by the time we were ready to dive, we deliberately had a thing where we had the ship drive a couple of miles away from where we wanted to study and prove that we could dive to the seafloor and then drive sideways, because we would need to do that if we were under the ice. We can't make guarantee the icebreaker will make a hole right over the vents. Mm. Those vents, it turned out, had did. It was the first time, it was one of the first times we were able to definitively prove the theory that, yep, here we could see brand new molecules being formed during the hydrothermal circulation that were organic molecules, these precursor to life molecules, were actually doing what theory said.
Right.
So it could happen in nature. And then what Julie's team was doing at the same time was looking at how much energy was available for microbiology and then showing how that cascaded out into like a massive diversity of different microbes there. So that all said, okay, so then we should totally go to the Arctic. It now makes sense. And so we were interested anyway. And then about halfway through the time we were doing that was when this revolution started happening in space exploration, when people realized that in the outer solar system there are these moons of giant planets which are ice-covered, but they have oceans with rocky seafloors. So we know that physics, chemistry, and geology all work in space. So it kind of follows that if they've got a rocky seafloor and water, there must be some way that water and rock are interacting. So there might be some kind of geothermal energy. Mm-hmm. There might be the right chemistry. And then the question is, so then does that mean there's a perfectly habitable seafloor and nothing on it? Or is it a perfectly habitable seafloor and it's inhabited?
Yeah, I would say, when we're looking for life, we're not talking about, you know, gray men with big black eyes. We're talking about microbes. We're talking about small life.
Well, that's certainly the starting point.
Yeah.
Right. And then you would expect that the total amount of energy for life is going to be much less if it's only the geothermal component. If you think if you took away the sunlight on Earth, the amount of life we would have on Earth would be a lot less.
Right.
So, but yeah, definitely at the starting point. If you look at the evolution of life on our own planet, it seems like the first evidence for single-celled life goes right back to pretty much as soon as like bombardment of the planet finished, as soon as any water environment was set up, there seems to be evidence of fossil evidence of life goes right back to the beginning of the planet. The first multicellular organisms come with like the Precambrian explosion or the Cambrian explosion. So it's like 1,000 million years. So there's, you know,
very exciting.
Half to three quarters of Earth's history. If you'd come looking for life, if some other culture had come to Earth looking for life, they would only have found microbes for the first 3,000 million years.
Yeah, wow. So are you talking directly with NASA or other space exploration agencies about your research and findings then? I mean, some of this is actually funded by NASA, right?
Yeah. So we've actually been running a large program for the last 5 years here at Woods Hole. We've actually just been last few months putting in to renew that for another new five-year program. But yeah, about half of our funding to do the work that we've done working on vents in the Arctic now, we've actually tracked the first vents to source and studied them. And again, they're these very hydrogen-rich systems. About half of that funding has come from NASA. And there's an increasing number of people at Woods Hole. It's healthy to have multiple funding streams for an organization
for sure.
like Woods Hole. And so this is a new one that we've been able to open up.
All right. So do you have any interest in space exploration yourself? They go, come on, Chris, we're going to bring you up to space and doesn't know.
It's like I'm perfectly happy to send robots. You know, there's only so many peanut butter and jelly sandwiches you can have like you get in Alvin.
So the technology or systems that you're using in the Arctic, are these, I mean, you're talking about some of it, are there newer technologies that are like first time you'll be testing anything, or is this pretty much some of the same things that you've been using in other places?
No, it's actually, NASA are really good about recognizing that in terms, in fact, they won't actually fund half of the programs are ones where you have to be advancing the technology as well. So again, it's like right in Woods Hole's wheelhouse. So two advances. One is teaching robots to be more and more intelligent and working out how they can do things. So the most recent program I was in last September, we actually had the data coming from a free-swimming robot on the seafloor. We were using the telemetry system instead of sending, well, we were piping video ashore of what the ROV was doing. But I also had an AUV that was sending the data ashore to a colleague at JPL. He was running some test software to run through and do the analyses at the same time that I was doing it on the ship and working out where should the robot go next and sending that back in a matter of 15 minutes. So actually inside, while the robot was still on the seafloor, we were then using acoustics to send new lines of computer code of telling it where to go next. The second thing is that people have been working on deep sea gliders. So these are now things that can go out and can actually swim across ocean basins. And so that's one of the next big challenges is getting those that can go deep. And funnily enough, there's a company right here in North Falmouth, about two blocks along from where I live, is actually one of the pioneers for that. So we're exploring how you can actually get something that could actually go deep and long range. They have a prototype vehicle that can go to 4,000 meters, which could actually get to the depth of vent sites. They have other vehicles that can go out for a year or two at a time that only go to 1,000 meters. But if you can combine those two, you can actually get to the point if you could go out and explore ocean basins via robot. And now I don't even have to leave home. So it's getting like, I can even, my wife will hate it, but I can retire and not go to sea anymore. But I can just sneak off when she's not looking and let my robots explore.
And it's amazing when you think back to when you started your career and the advances that we've had in technology and what we've learned and still what yet there is to explore. It's quite amazing.
Yeah. I mean, our technology's got great. When I first went to sea, we only had enough GPS satellites to know actually where we were for 4 hours a day. Mm. The other 20 hours, we were just trying to work out how far the ship had drifted. Now we can, telemeter all over the place. And we do, and we have space technology that may have flown past, but that's the thing. Our science understanding is exploding fast, at least as fast as the technology. Yeah. So we didn't know it at the time, but we've probably got spacecraft that could have flown past life beyond Earth 20 years ago. We just were oblivious.
Yeah. And the fact that I'm sure you didn't think about this when you started your career, that you'd be, using this research to inform what's happening in space.
No.
Yeah, right?
That's the thing. People think like science fiction. You must have really thought ahead to think about that. And it was, one of the first interviews that I ever did, I'd actually said to the Times newspaper in London that anybody who thought that life originated at hydrothermal vents or claimed that was a charlatan. Because at the time, what we knew is that all the big animals we know nowadays, their physiology requires there not just to be the energy from the vents, but they need oxygen in the seawater as well to react mm-hmm. with those chemicals. And the oxygen's only been there because of photosynthesis, and that's quite a recent development in Earth history. But it's at any one time, you can. That's what I've learned is, I used to speak definitively when I was young because I thought I knew everything that everybody knew so far.
So far, right.
And then as I've got wiser, it's just made me more and more humble of how much I still don't know.
And every scientific question you answer raises several more questions, right? So, And so what advice do you have for the next generation who might be interested, in science and research?
Let's think. If it's a program, if it's a subject that's of interest to you, then pursue it. Exactly where your field is going to take you. I mean, I thought I was going to be a chemical engineer when I left high school and went to college. That's what I was planning to do. I thought I was going to go work for Exxon or Shell or DuPont, something like that. I didn't know what other subjects were available to me. I didn't even know what geology was. Well, I did. I knew what geology was. It was digging in the mudflats of the Thames estuary because it's what my older brother and my mum used to do, and I just hated it when I was 13. I did not want to be out on a cold winter's day walking around in mud trying to keep the dog clean. But if you have an interest, pursue it and just be open-minded. Life is a journey and you don't quite know where it's going to take you. The stronger the grounding you can get to start with, that's good. I mean, in my case, I'm glad that I started out studying chemistry rather than trying to study oceanography or life in space, because the chemistry allowed me, that strong grounding, a bachelor's degree allowed me to then build out.
So be open. All right. Chris German, senior scientist at HUI, has explored hydrothermal vents and tracked life in extreme environments for the last 30 years. Chris, thanks for being here and telling us all. It's very exciting. Thanks for sharing all that info with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.